Tales from the Maine Woods. John Ford and Paul Fournier have seen it all. They've spent their lives in and around the Maine woods. Ford as a game warden, Fournier as a Maine guide and bush pilot, and for two decades, the spokesman for the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. I'm Keith Shortall. Join me for a conversation with these two seasoned veterans of the wilderness as they tell stories about the animals they've worked so hard to protect and the humans that share and sometimes abuse the natural resources that make Maine such a special place. We'd like to hear from you as well. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, post to the Maine Calling Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Two voices from the wilderness. This is Maine Calling. And welcome to my guests. We should also mention that you're both authors of books, which was one of the reasons we wanted to have you in here. John Ford, your book is called Suddenly the Cider Didn't Taste So Good. And Paul Fournier, yours is Tales from Misery Ridge. And I enjoyed reading both of them. And this is some really great stories that you can't make up, some of them. They have to be experienced after so many years in the Maine woods. John Ford, you joined the Maine Warden Service in 1970?
1970, yeah. It was 1970 in September. September 20th, 1970.
70 bucks a week?
70 bucks a week. And 110 hours.
110 hours. That seems like a good deal. Yeah. And it was actually, I read, it was, what, 6 days on and 2 days off?
Right, right. It's what we call the non-scheduled work week. And, you know, you had to answer all the complaints within your district 6 days a week, 24 hours a day.
It was a little different back then, I'm assuming, as well, in terms of how you operated.
Very much so.
Than it is today. We'll get into some of that. Paul Fournier, I think I've spoken to you probably in the past on stories about involving inland fisheries and wildlife. You were a registered Maine guide at the age of 18?
That's right. Yes, I began guiding at a place called Lakewood Camps at Middle Dam, Maine, on Lower Richardson Lake at 18 years of age, and it was quite an experience. Beautiful country up there then.
And that was probably a little different standards for registration for a Maine guide back then?
Absolutely. I would not have qualified. If I had to go through the guide board today, I'm sure I never would have been a guide. But in those days, all you needed was John, the game warden, would sign your application. And I bucked my poor game warden for about when I turned 17, and he said, not till you're 18. And finally he signed it just to get me off his neck, I guess.
Well, it was the beginning of a long
it certainly
career.
Was.
What is it? Why is it that some people look out the window of a remote cabin and see a pristine, beautiful playground, the best place they've ever seen, and others see gnats and cold, wet feet?
I think a lot of it is the makeup of the person themselves, and you know, if they like being in the wild or being out of doors, and it's something they've probably done as a youth. If they're not, then they're cabin bound.
Mm. Yeah, good Paul. Answer.
And both of you had experiences as kids, didn't you? You were sort of involved with the outdoors from the beginning.
Oh, absolutely. I started I was a trapper when I was about 15 or 16 years old, trapping small fur bearers, and that's how I made a little money to buy snowshoes and stuff, you know, and spent just an excuse to spend a lot of time in the woods.
And, John, your mother rehabbed wildlife?
She was a wildlife rehab for York County, and so we got to know all the game wardens, and my stepfather was actually a game warden down there. So I got to see most of the wildlife that you can imagine. We had about everything running around the house at one time or another.
A game warden is a sort of a policeman, but you're there to protect the wildlife, and they can't call 911 and say, help, I'm being poached. You have to kind of go out and look for the trouble.
Right. Right. That was the exciting part of the job was knowing your people, knowing the area, knowing where your wildlife was and the district that you was in, and to try to enforce the laws as we had them on the books at that time to give the coverage in those particular areas.
But you couldn't go out, I'm guessing, into as a new warden at that time in the 1970s and play Barney Fife and start arresting everybody, didn't you have to kind of get to know them and have them accept you a little bit?
Very much so. I mean, and that was the biggest setback that I had is when I went to Waldo County. I mean, poaching was a way of life up in the area that I lived in. And the game warden was kind of looked upon as a black plague. I mean, if you was in the area and went into a store, they'd all crowd behind the bread counter and wait for you to leave. And it took a while to break the ice and to get to know these people, but eventually it came around, and you know, it was some of the best people I ever met.
And eventually, over time, as I read in your book, there is no honor among poachers. Once you caught one, the others would sometimes turn their colleagues in, right?
Exactly. That there seemed to be a trend. It was very territorial. That you know, if one had an area that he liked to poach in, he didn't want neighbors coming in there, and so it'd be nothing for them to what we call squeal on one another, and sometimes thinking they was getting in the good graces of the game warden, so that it might be to their benefit in the long run.
Paul, is that how you saw it, that poaching in certain parts of Maine was an accepted part of culture?
Yes, absolutely. I remember John may have been involved in Operation Red Coat one time up in the Dover-Foxcroft area, and the people, there was a little country store there, and they had a refrigerator right by the counter. The store was about the size of this room here, a very small store. What they were selling was deer meat. They'd go out at night and poach deer. They had a refrigerator right there, and the deer meat was all wrapped up, and the truck drivers and whatever would stop in and pick up the weekly supply of deer meat right there.
So that was a money-making enterprise.
Yes, it was.
I'm guessing, though, that for some Maine people of meager means, they were poaching to feed their families. I'm not justifying poaching, but were some of them doing it out of necessity? Or
I think back in the 70s, Keith, I think that was a way of life for a lot of people. I mean, you didn't have the welfare programs that we've got today. And the other thing was people had a lot of pride that they didn't want to go on welfare, didn't want anybody knowing it. I came from an area that there was a lot of old farmland, and night hunting was almost a way of life for some of these people. It was the family survival.
Let's, for those who are, we don't want to give people a primer on how to poach, but I do want to talk about some of the forms of poaching. When we're talking about poaching, it's not only taking more than your limit as set by law, but it's certain hunting techniques that you're not allowed to do. And probably the most, we're talking about mostly deer hunting and fishing and probably trapping. Paul is a public education guy. What are some of the most common forms of deer poaching, for example?
Well, I guess probably the most common one is night hunting in Maine. And I did get out with the wardens a number of times and sat out with them, and that's a pretty exciting thing. It can be boring for a long time, but when action happens, the adrenaline really gets shooting, and John has been involved in a lot of those. I might add that the first time I met John, he had found some fellows, out-of-state guys, had a cabin in the woods, and they had set up a very elaborate deer trap. And I was called by the chief warden. I was not really an employee at the time, but I was a friend of the department. He called me, says, at 5 o'clock in the morning, says, I'll pick you up in a few minutes and bring your camera. So we went out to John's place, and John had caught these fellows. They had this deer trap, and they had an alarm system rigged up so that a can full of rocks would fall in the sink if the So he tripped the trap, and when they came out there, instead of finding a deer, they found John. And they were armed men, you know.
Right, I read that was a tense moment for you, John, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a Mexican standoff at 3 o'clock in the morning with three night hunters and looking at the barrel of a 12-gauge, and they was in their pajamas and not really wide awake, so.
And you had a pistol with it.
I had a .38 pea shooter that, you know, it's like taking a pea shooter to a fight in the war today, so.
But the point I was going to make there was that these fellows, John's a kind of a guy, the good kind of warden. After he arrested them, they became his good buddies. They invited him out for coffee and whatever. There were a few wardens that had that trait. John was one, and I remember Charlie Davis was one up in Greenville. I saw him arrest some guys one day ice fishing, and before he was done, they were his best friends. You know, he just had a great personality.
What is that, John? Did they trust you, or they thought of you as just doing your job?
Well, I think it depends on the person themselves, Keith. I know when I first went to that area, my stepfather told me, he says, if you want to get the respect of the people you're going to deal with, you want to treat them the way you'd want to be treated yourself. And that probably was some of the best advice I could have gotten. And he said, and if you're going to err on the side, if you think it's an intentional violation or whatever, err on the side of them rather than the department, and he says you'll gain the respect. And I think that paid off big dividends. It was good advice.
Some of these guys were pretty inventive, too, weren't they, about the ways that they took too many of a certain species? And I'm thinking of the smelter who had a technique for getting smelt by you.
Oh, yeah. Those ways that they could find, if they could find a way to beat the game warden, I mean, it was almost a game. It was a cat and mouse game, and it was kind of fun, actually. The case that you talk about was a case where the guy had walked by me night after night and always had his limit. Well, come find out he had more than the limit because he had chest waders on, and he'd fill his buckets up with a legal limit and dump the rest down his chest waders. And the only way I found out about it was that he kept bragging around the bonfire that these guys had every night to keep themselves warm, and they kind of got PO'd at him and ratted him out. And when I finally picked him up, he ratted out one of the guys that ratted him out, leaving his bucket up beside the road and coming back later. So, I mean, that was the way the game was played, and you know, we just didn't take it personal.
And so at the end, they were still your friends, or they treated you?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. I mean, it was if you could get your foot in the door and have a cup of coffee with them afterwards, you knew you'd accomplished the task. Not everybody was like that, but for the most part, the Maine sportsman is probably some of the best people you're ever going to run across. And
good point.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. That number again, 1-800-399-3566. Paul mentioned night hunting. There's also a practice called deer driving. John, I wonder if you could explain what that is.
Well, deer driving is when a gang gets together that's hunting together, and they spread out a few feet apart, come down through an area of woods that's known to have deer in there, and they have people set on stands along the way that are known deer crossings, and it's kind of an unfair advantage for the deer itself, and it's a good way for hunting fatalities. I mean,
I was going to say you're walking toward each other with guns aimed at each other.
Right.
And night hunting also just doesn't sound safe to me as well.
No, and that's where they put the light out the window, and you know, if they see the yellow eyes of a deer, it hypnotizes the deer and it makes them an easy prey. So, yeah, it's quite a practice.
And apart from protecting animals from poachers, there are just some species, Paul, that you've probably seen come and go or struggle and come back again. And I'm thinking of the bald eagle, for example. Back in the 70s, I don't think growing up here, I never saw a bald eagle except
A
stamp. And now I see one driving to work every day.
Yeah, it's been a remarkable recovery. Back in the 60s, there were only like 30 active nests in Maine that were actually producing young, and they were only producing one or two young. And that was mostly in eastern Maine. There were a few nests around the Merrimeeting Bay and the Kennebec River, but they were not reproducing. The eggs would just lie there in the nest and rot, just dry up. And that was when the first efforts were made. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Maine Fish and Wildlife Department got together, and they went out to Minnesota and got a few viable eggs in a national forest there where there had been no spraying. DDT was what killed them. And they brought those eggs back and put them in a nest, and it was a pretty difficult thing. But they did manage to raise the first year one eagle. That was in 1975 or 6. And from that, the comeback has by then, the DDT spraying had been eliminated, and so they came back. But they found two eggs in Maine that were the most polluted eggs ever found in eagle eggs or in any bird eggs on Merrimeeting Bay in Maine.
So it's exciting for you to see pairs nesting now.
Well, now we're up over, last I heard, over 400 nesting pairs in Maine, so it's just remarkable.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
On the next Backstory.
Before Las Vegas was Las Vegas, couples looking to get married in a hurry knew where to go, to the tiny town of Elkton, Maryland.
People were talking about the Honeymoon Express rolling into Elkton. And what it was doing was it was bringing, like, somebody's over 100 couples getting off that train.
Find out why on the next Backstory as we explore the ever-changing institution of marriage in the USA.
Join us for Backstory Friday afternoon at 1 o'clock. As you know, many businesses and organizations in and around Maine join listeners in supporting various public radio programs on the MPBN radio service. To learn how your business can benefit from supporting MPBN, either on MPBN radio or on MPBN television, visit our website, mpbn.net. Click on Business Support to find information about the value of sponsorship, answers to frequently asked questions, and contact information. Or you can call us at 1-800-884-1717 and ask for Susan Tran. And of course, thank you for your support of public broadcasting here in Maine. Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by Travelers Insurance, offering auto, home, boat insurance, and more to clients in Maine and nationwide. More information available online at goodbehavior.com, and by the University of Maine at Presque Isle, offering merit awards to make earning your degree even more affordable. Learn more at umpi.edu/merit awards.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we're talking about making your way around the great Maine outdoors. And with me in the studio, John Ford. He's a retired Maine game warden and author of Suddenly the Cider Didn't Taste So Good. Also with me, Paul Fournier. He was a registered Maine guide and bush pilot. For 20 years, he was the public information officer for the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. He's the author of Tales from Misery Ridge. We'd like to hear from you. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net and tweet at Maine Calling. And we have a tweet from a listener who writes, a bear watching while I worked in the garden, and in the years since, I learned to be comfortable and respectful of bears. They go on to say, I was a little freaked out, though, when the warden told me to keep a gun handy, but you won't need it. Black bears, I grew up learning that they were not particularly dangerous unless they had a cub. Is that about right, John?
That's the way I've seen it. All the time that I was a warden, I think in 20 years, I probably saw a total of three. Usually, you know, I mean, if a bear and if it had cubs, obviously it's going to protect its young. But most of the time, they hear you long before you around, and they're gone. And a bear can actually run faster than a deer. So, you know, like I said, it's a rarity if you see them around.
But you should keep your garbage inside.
Right, because our bird feeders are, at this time of year, early in the spring, the bird feeders with the suet. Isn't attractive for them, but, you know, if someone goes out, usually they'll run.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Let's go to Waldoboro and Nick. Hi, Nick. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I've got a question for John Ford there. Oh, it must have been better than 30 years ago. I got to know John Marsh a little bit. He was chief warden back then, I think, and I was wondering if he's still around, doing all right, or how he's doing.
John Marsh lives in West Gardner.
I've been out to his house back then.
And he's a collector of old tractors. At the time, he still has a great interest in the warden service. And John Marsh really was one of my idols back when I was working. We worked a lot together. We had some great times together. And I could probably write a John Marsh book, but a lot of those stories wouldn't be made for public. So
I know. We were riding around, and he told me a few. And I actually told him about some friends of mine down here on the coast, and he said, oh, they're awful killers, he said.
He knew most of them.
Yeah. No, he is a good fella. So I'm glad to hear he's still doing well.
He's doing well.
Yeah. Geez, the way he lives out there, if he's still got the same old house, boy, that's an old-time living, the way he lives.
Well, he and his wife had a mariner down in Brunswick, I think it was, down around that way. They've retired and turned it over to the children now, I think. But John still
well,
does farming.
West Gardner, where I mean, his house. I think
yeah.
That's where it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's out in the country.
Yeah. Yeah. He still had an old kitchen range and just living like the old days.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. Good fella. Yeah. Anyhow. Glad
right.
to hear he's still going good.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah,
all right, see you, Nick. Thank you. 1-800-399-3566. I'm wondering about how times have changed. You're retired now, John, but I assume that the job of warden has changed a lot since the time you got in 1970. What's it like today as compared to what it used to be?
Well, I think the thing is, Keith, I knew my time had come. When we went to the Garcia ruling and wardens had to be paid financially. They had to be paid a time off. The non-standard work week actually left, and it affected all of law enforcement nationwide. And we went to shift work at that time, and, you know, it had changed so much that we kind of lost personal contact with the people in our district because we expanded. We was going into areas that we didn't know. We was dealing with people we didn't know, and you know, the career that I had wanted to live had really changed halfway through, and I knew my time had come. And
so earlier you kind of spent you sort of lived the job a little bit more than
definitely. Yeah. I mean, for a warden, the family takes a beating on it because you're gone all the time. I don't think there was hardly a Thanksgiving that I got to spend with the family, and because that was a busy day. And you know, I mean, it's just you was on call 24 hours a day and getting up in the middle of the night. My wife has heard more profanity come out of me at early in the morning, go on a cardiac accident or something, and, you know, and it really ate into the family life. But we really got so we accepted it, and today it's just so much different. That
Yeah. Paul, did you notice a change over the years?
Oh, absolutely, yes, very much so, yeah.
Same thing?
Yeah, very much so. I think another change was that the early days, the wardens were pretty much local boys. They were boys that grew up on farms and so forth. And now you're more likely to get college graduates, and some of those have not been exposed to some of the hardships, so they may find it a little difficult out there. I don't know. John may want to comment on that.
Well, it was. It was so much different back then because when I came to work, the only thing they gave me was a little brass compass, a .38 revolver. I didn't even go to warden school for 6 months. I was put into the field, and today, I mean, we didn't have portable radios, we didn't have GPS, we didn't have computers or any of the rest of that stuff, and, you know, you was pretty well on your own, and it was kind of like on-the-job training, and, you know, I think the thing is you can't teach common sense, and I think the job requires common sense, and it also requires a lot of compassion, so you gotta try to instill that into the people today. Everything seems to be black and white today, and there's no gray area. And I think that was a big downfall that bothered me the most when I finally got ready to pull the plug.
1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Portland. And Dan, hi, Dan.
How you doing?
Good, thanks. Go ahead, please.
I was just wondering if you guys had read any of these books where a game warden, you know, the mystery type books where a game warden is a central character, and if so, what do you think about them?
I've read the one that I believe Mr. Dorian's got out. I liked it.
Paul Dorian.
I think it's a very good, very well written book. You know, I mean, it's not certainly like the life of a real game warden, but there's enough in there that I can associate with it, and I really enjoyed it. Matter of fact, I want to get the others so I can read that too.
Yeah, I've read them both. Yeah.
All right, Dan, thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you.
1-800-399-3566 to South Portland and Bob. Hi, Bob.
Hi there, guys. Thanks so much for taking my call. Warden, thank you for being such a nice guy. You know, it sounds like over the phone you're just the kind of person that should be doing that kind of work. I have to tell you up front, I really am completely opposed to wildlife trapping, especially using what seems to me to be medieval torture devices, and I realized that steel leg hole traps have been banned finally in Maine. But what I've heard, when black bears are caught in these sickening devices, that when the trapper approaches them, hopefully they're doing it quickly and they're not suffering for a couple of days, which I've heard happens, the bear actually bawls or cries like a human being would, out of fear, knowing that its executioner is coming. I'm wondering, with the compassion that you sound like you have now that you're retired, if you believe that wildlife trapping, especially using painful devices that can maim and hurt animals, is something that we should allow in the 21st century in the state of Maine, where we only have 2,000 trappers, most of them are recreational, very, very few are relying on trapping for their livelihood. Why, in a state that has millions of people?
Yeah. Okay. Let's let him answer the question. Go ahead, John.
Well, there's no question. It's a controversial issue, and I can remember back when it first started coming to the forefront that there was some incidents that happened where actually people that on the opposing side claimed to have gotten caught into traps and so forth, and we found out some of that was staged. I don't think I want to myself get involved in it. I think it's been a way of life for years. I don't think it's as inhumane as what it's being portrayed as, and these traps are supposed to be checked every 24 hours, and
You were hired to carry out the laws of the state of Maine, not to make policy, just to be fair. You are not administrators of inland fisheries and wildlife. It's an important issue. I'm just not sure that that's this program. But 1-800-399-3566. And let's go to Bedford and Bob. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment on how the older game wardens, I'm talking back in the 60s and 70s, used to gain respect. I'll never forget, back in the old days up on the West Branch, we used to have to either walk in 3 miles or drive a four-wheel drive and walk the last. And we come out, we knew there was going to be a checkpoint, and we put our smelts in the backpack and then pick up beer cans around the area. And the game warden checked us one night. He said, "Those all your beer cans?" I said, "No." He said, "I don't need to see your smelts." And that's how he gained respect. We were legal, but just the idea that we picked up extra beer cans, he let one slide. And that went a lot. That went far for gaining our respect.
Now, Bob, are there other wardens that you just didn't seem to connect to, didn't like?
Later on. Back then, it just seemed like a different breed back then.
Yeah. Is there any?
They're more like police officers now.
Yeah, I think that's where the black and white comes in. I think a lot of the training and stuff is so much different today than what we had back then. And you got to figure that a game warden is out there on his own. And if he's going to get the respect, he's got to earn that respect. And you've got to have fair play. There's no question that job security was those that violated the law, and there was plenty of them that did it. But for the most part, I think that people were pretty upright and honest, and you had to treat them that way.
Is there any advice that either of you would give a game warden starting out now today as a young?
I'll defer to John.
Well, I think I would start the same thing. I mean, I look at what my stepfather told me, that to treat the people the way I'd want to be treated myself. And if you're going to err on the side of a violation, err on the side of the person that you're confronting. And you may have some slide by you. I found out the hardcore poacher that you may let him get by with one or two, but sooner or later, if he keeps at it, that tide's going to turn, and you're going to run across him again. And I had my regulars that I could count on every year. And even them, we got along well, and it was a game.
Let's go quickly to Mark, who's in the car. Hi, Mark.
Hi, this is Mark. I'm calling about one of the wardens that was quite a hero up in the Allagash area. And he was like a John Wayne type game warden, bigger than life, but he was only like 5'6". And there's two legends about him before he was had to be removed from the service, because some poachers he caught them poaching a moose, and one of them tricked him, and what they did is they tied him up on a tree across the Canadian border, and took off with the moose. And eventually he got out of the moose trap, and he tracked the poachers down into a logging area, and he followed the blood trail, and they lugged it right into the main cook camp. This particular warden, it was their dining hall, and they were all eating, all these Canadian loggers. He grabbed his tow chain, and he walked it right through the chow cabin. And in the back room, there was a shower. And he started tying the chain on the moose's leg that was stuffed up in behind the rafters. And they said to him, "What are you doing?" He says, "You guys aren't going to help me lug this moose out. I'm going to yank it out with my truck right through the lodge." And all of a sudden, all the woodsmen said, "Oh, no, we'll load that moose for you." So they helped him load that onto the truck. And,
and that's leverage. All right. Well, we're going to take another short break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
I'm Catherine Lanford. Coming up on America Abroad.
If you don't have a civil society where kids learn to respect a Christian or a Jew, you're going to have major problems.
How will religious minorities in the Middle East fare in an era of revolution and the rise of Islamist governments? Religious minorities in the Middle East on the next America Abroad from Public Radio International.
Join us for that America Abroad program tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock. And join us this afternoon at 1 o'clock, immediately following Maine Calling, for the Commonwealth Club of California. We will hear a panel discussion about the question of nuclear power revival in the United States. That's this afternoon at 1 o'clock here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, stories about the great Maine outdoors. And with me in the studio, John Ford, a retired Maine game warden and author of Suddenly the Cider Didn't Taste So Good. Also with me, Paul Fournier. He was a registered Maine guide and bush pilot. And for 20 years, he was the public information officer for the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. He's the author of Tales from Misery Ridge. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net. Post to our Facebook page or tweet at Maine Calling. We do have a tweet asking about, are there any stories about women hunters in Maine woods? Because there are a lot of stories about men, but women in Maine were hunters and outdoors women and trappers as well. Were they not, John?
Yeah, they were. Actually, I wrote one in my book about there was one particular trapper that I'd had a lot of trouble with, and he had his license suspended for a year. The following year, I figured he'd be right back out, so I set up not too far from his place, and the very opening day of the trapping season, I heard a vehicle coming down through the woods. I'd found a place where they pre-baited for Fisher, and it ended up that it was his wife and another lady that actually went out there and set a trap, and I wasn't sure what they'd done, and like an idiot, I'd gone out there and brushed the dirt away from that trap and got my hand caught in it, and they was just a little ways away, and I wanted to holler and swear because it hurt so bad, but these were two women that they knew the trick of the trade, and they'd done pretty darn good, and there's a lot of women that are really well-educated on the sporting aspect.
And there's one right in the other room, our own Aaron Merrill as well. Right?
Definitely.
1-800-399-3566 to Bradford and David. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I had a question. I have some land in Bradford, and it's a minor problem up there, but I also spent some time in Ohio, and it's a big problem there. It's deer that become pests, basically, and they start eating crops and decorative plants and sometimes even, breaking through little flimsy fences to do that. Is there some recourse that you have in terms of the deer if it becomes a pest? Can you shoot it or anything?
Well, there's stuff you can put out that supposedly will drive them away. I know that's a problem that's quite common, especially down in around the York County area and along the coast. Drake's Island, I think, in Wells is a perfect example of it, where the deer was eating some of the real precious shrubbery that then they had to open up a season to go in there and actually thin them out. You know, deer are going to go where the feed is easy, and, you know, that to try to do as best you can to keep them away. As a last resort, you may have to end up eradicating them.
Let's go back to the bear question to Cherryfield and Bill. Hi, Bill.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. I live down in Cherryfield here, blueberry capital of the world, and I live right in the middle of town on the Narragansett River. And for the last three nights, I've been visited by a big bear who's come down and smashed up my chicken coop and taken four of my chickens. And I'm wondering, doesn't that seem like really unusual behavior to you?
I would think it would be for this time of year, but, you know, they're going to like bear about like people. They're going to go where the food is easy and, you know, at...
surrounded by blueberry fields and everything else.
Well, the blueberries ripe yet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they're ripe. They start raking tomorrow.
Yeah.
I guess he just liked chicken.
Yeah. What did I do? They've already put out a bear barrel trap for 10 days, and he's not in it.
Is it still coming?
Last night, the last three nights in a row.
Yeah, I would try to work something out with the local warden down there, but you know, if it's been able to get food out of there, it's probably going to keep coming back for a while, and you know.
I know a bear can run down a deer and eat it, but this time of year, I never heard of one.
Yeah, I think that's a little unusual in my opinion. What do you think, Paul? Is that?
What was that?
Do you think it's normal for this time of year for them to
grow? Oh, yeah. A lot of the bear crops aren't really ripened up yet. The blueberries haven't ripened up. So they'll take food where they can find
it. Where they can find it.
Well,
all right, let's go to Camden now. And Ron. Hi, Ron. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hi. First of all, I want to say hi to Paul. Paul Roncho. It's been a long time, Paul. We've had some good times together, Paul and I, when I worked for the department in the 70s and again in the 80s. I had a lot of good film sessions with Paul out in the woods, and those are treasured, Paul. So welcome back to Maine.
Thank you much.
I got a question for John, if I may.
Sure.
In the years that I worked for the department, in the late 70s as a wildlife biologist, and then again in the 80s, late 80s, I came back after a break of about 10 years. And what was really noticeable to me was, as you mentioned, the skill level and the game wardens, the young guys coming up, and I don't mean to jump on the younger wardens, but they, to me, it was very obvious in the 10 years I was gone that the new wardens lacked just what you said, common sense and how to get along with people. And my question is, does the Criminal Justice Academy that teaches the game wardens, do they ever invite you or some of the older wardens to come and help instill those skills that you've learned? Because I think it's a shame that they haven't been able to pick that up.
Yeah, they haven't. I think some of us have been back. But the other thing, too, that, Ron, that has changed is the duties of a warden constantly increases. Every time the legislature passes a new law that pertains to off the road, it's the game warden that ends up picking up the duties of enforcement. I can remember when I come on that the old-time wardens before me said that, you know, they'd seen the best of it, and that now you've got these snowmobiles coming in, and snowmobiles was just coming into place when I was on there, boating laws that they never enforced. So you kind of got away from the fish and wildlife aspect of it, and in doing that, people's attitudes have changed, society's attitudes have changed. I noticed a big change at the end of it, that the respect that law enforcement used to have, whether it be state police or whatever, is no longer the same respect that that we had back in those days.
Right.
So I think a lot of it is a society issue that it just changed.
Yeah, well, I was with Charlie Davis up on Moosehead Lake years ago, and he caught a man with his son, had over his limit, and Charlie really handled that so professionally. And here's this man with a kid. He's teaching his kid how to catch poached fish. And Charlie handled that so well that the man actually thanked him for writing a ticket at the end. And I was really blown away by how phenomenal Charlie Davis was, and Charlie Marshall, and a lot of these old-time wardens were just, they were fantastic.
All of those guys did that. And you know, I look at a case where sometimes it pays off. I remember running across a guy that didn't have a license, and he had a big family. They was catching white perch when the white perch was running, and he didn't have his license with him. And I told him, I wrote the summons out, and I said, I'm going to give you probably 3 or 4 weeks. If you buy a license and come back and show it to me, I'll rip this summons up. As a result of that one move, I had a hunting accident that John Marsh and I was working on that we didn't know who the shooter was. And as a result of that one accident, when that guy came back with his fishing license and a thank you for not making him go to court, which would have taken away from the family, he gave me enough information. I found out who that shooter was. So sometimes it paid off beneficially, and I think some of these guys today don't realize that sometimes by passing on a little break like that, that the dividends in the long run can be quite beneficial.
And we have a little thunder lightning going over our studio, and I think we just lost the phones. So, okay. Anyway, we'll keep trying again if we can fit in a call, if they are indeed working, 1-800-399-3566. There's a story also, John, in your book about a poacher who hides a deer, if that's possible, in a place in his house that he doesn't think you're probably going to look.
Right, right. I didn't actually write about that one, but I've told it several times. And it was a case in Burnham where a gentleman had shot a deer at 1 o'clock in the morning, and the neighbor had called in and notified the state police barracks that he, in fact, had shot a deer, dragged it back to the house. And my partner, Norman Gilbert, and I was just a little ways from there, so we immediately went to the residence. Meantime, someone had heard it on the scanner that he, in fact, had killed this deer and had it in the house, and they notified him that we was on our way. So when we got there, the guy was perfectly willing to have us search the house, and we did. And I found a few deer hairs, but that was quite common in a Burnham house at that time and wasn't enough to bring a charge. So in looking around, there's one room that we hadn't searched, and I asked him what was in there, and he said that his wife was in there, and she'd had the flu, and she'd been sick for about a week. And I said, do you mind if I look in? He said, well, I don't care if you look in, but I don't want you bothering Mother. And when I put the light in there, she peeked out from underneath the blankets, and just as white as a ghost, and looked quite sick. And years went by, and he finally came to my house and told me that deer I was looking for that night was in bed with Mother. So that was one of those cases where
some people will go to any length.
They love to be able to come back and say how they pulled the wool over the warden's eyes. Yeah. And he was quite proud of that. Matter of fact, this guy actually wrote his own book and put that story in there.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much for being with us today. John Ford, a retired Maine game warden and author of Suddenly the Cider Didn't Taste So Good. Also with me, Paul Fournier, registered Maine guide and bush pilot, longtime spokesman for the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, and the author of Tales from Misery Ridge. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Today's program produced by Jonathan Smith. John Keimel ran the board. We had help from the MPBN web team and from Aaron Merrill. Tomorrow on the program, join guest host Erwin Gratz for a discussion about the recent events in the Middle East. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.